The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. We are here for oral arguments this morning. 22 AP 959 CR, State versus Ramirez. Appearances, please. Good morning. All right, the lineup I have is 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes in rebuttal. Is that your understanding? Great. With that, let's proceed.
May it please the court. The state takes the important constitutional right to a speedy trial seriously. We are not denying that the nearly 4 years Mr. Ramirez waited for his trial was considerable and should have been shorter. But, especially in light of Ramirez's lack of prejudice resulting from the delay, his constitutional rights were not violated. The Court of Appeals erred in holding otherwise. The Court of Appeals has created confusing and unworkable binding precedent. In particular, it applied a nebulous cavalier disregard for a speedy trial right to require the state to provide a sufficient explanation for why the case did not come back into court sooner, even after a valid delay. This is wrong for at least two reasons. First, the term cavalier disregard is not founded in Barker or its progeny. This court should bring the concept into line with Supreme Court precedent found in Doggett that a defendant does not need to show actual prejudice if the delay is presumptively prejudicial. Second, this standard is unworkable for prosecutors and circuit courts. It would require the state to provide explanations for the delays in cases not in a trial posture, in case one day that case does go to trial. There are four areas the state is asking this court to correct and clarify. As to the first step in the Barker analysis, the Court of Appeals noted the overall length of the delay and weighed that heavily against the state. This court should hold that the overall length of the delay and the presumption of prejudice are merely triggering mechanisms to complete the rest of the Barker analysis.
Can I stop you there for 1 second? Do you agree that it was at least presumptive? The amount of the delay?
Under the first step, yes.
Okay.
But that's just a triggering mechanism to continue, and it's a delay of approaching 1 year is sufficient to find a presumption of prejudice. That differs from what the state's calling presumptive prejudice under the fourth step, consistent with Doggett.
Okay. So you're saying it's just a triggering mechanism?
Correct. Any delay for any reason, that's why you have to go through the next step, step two, where you apportion the delays, determine the reason for them, and assign them weight. In theory, a defendant could, by making requests for adjournments, have a trial that takes over a year to come to trial. That would still trigger under the first step, but after you go through the analysis and apportion the weight and the reason for the delay, it would be very unlikely to show a speedy trial violation.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead with your 2, 3, and 4.
Under the second step of the Barker analysis, the court apportions responsibility for the adjournments and the delays, but the Court of Appeals has created confusion on at least three different topics.
Attorney Flynn, I think what bothers me when I look at this 46-month delay to get to trial, I think the state made three requests for an adjournment and the defense won. The one that gets under my skin the most is the DA saying because of a retirement in their office, they can't be prepared to try a case. I know you worked in the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office. I work there as well. I know the culture there. I know that we would walk down a hallway and be handed a file and told, go try this case. There's a spin in another courtroom. You know, I don't expect that everybody is able to do that, but I do expect somebody can come up to speed and be able to try a case where the facts, to me, seem relatively simple. How do you respond to that?
Justice Protosevich, the state is not saying that it doesn't count as a reason. We believe it's a neutral reason. Gets towards the ordinary demands of the justice system. Prosecutors need to be able to retire.
Yeah, but prosecutors also need to be able to be prepared to try a case. That's the one that bothers me the most of all the requests.
To the extent that this court wants to hold that reason against the state, and I'm not saying it can't, it's not, it shouldn't weigh heavily against the state. It is a reason that happens due to life and retirement. It was not intended to prejudice Mr. Ramirez, and it did not prejudice Mr. Ramirez. It wasn't intended to gain an advantage or hurt his defense. So it's not something that should weigh heavily.
But it should weigh, I think, just to clarify what you're saying, it should weigh against the state.
Correct, as a neutral reason for the adjournment, which counts against the state.
So that's the final 244 days.
Correct.
So are you, if you're clarifying what it means to weigh heavily, because that is something that may need some clarification from the Court of Appeals decision, how would you define that? I heard you just give us maybe a way in which you would do that.
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. In the state's view, when an adjournment should weigh heavily against the state is first and foremost intentional delays, an intent to make the state's case better or the defendant's defense worse. And whether a defendant has made a valid and applicable speedy trial demand is another factor that if delays after a speedy trial demand make it seem more intentional. The second area that weighs heavily is a cavalier disregard, which comes from Borjegi, which takes its cues from Green, but it's not clear that that's what this court meant in Green. The quote from Green is, the elements of the delay that are to be weighed heavily against the state are, one, intentional delay designed to disadvantage the defendant's defense, two, a cavalier disregard of the defendant's right, three, missing or forgetful witnesses, and four, prolonged pretrial incarceration. Now, those last two are the factors that go into play when considering step four and determining whether there's any prejudice. So it's unclear in this sentence what exactly a cavalier disregard means. That sounds like a conclusion, not an independent factor.
So what would you have us do with the words cavalier disregard?
Cavalierly disregard them? Sorry.
I'm asking this court to bring that term of art into line with what Doggett says, that prolonged delays that are the state's responsibility approach a point where the defendant doesn't need to show actual prejudice. That's the presumptive prejudice under Doggett and its progeny. I think those two terms can come together in that way to give effect to what a cavalier disregard is, but recognize that it's not separate from Supreme Court precedent.
Mr. Flynn, I want to take a slight detour here. When I'm thinking about your arguments and the arguments of your friends on the other side, there is a lot of conversation about balancing of different rights. And in your petition for review, you noted that this court had not considered the issues under Barker for decades. Mr. Ramirez pointed out in his first brief that there are provisions, of course, for speedy trial both under the U.S. Constitution, right, the Sixth Amendment, and the Wisconsin Constitution under Article 1, Section 7. But something that neither of you addressed is how we should factor in another provision in the Wisconsin Constitution found under Article 1, 9M, and that is the rights of victims, right? And so here you have a victim who has been stabbed in the face and in the neck by a pencil. Under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9M, Sub 2 says, in order to preserve and protect victims' rights to justice and due process throughout the criminal and juvenile justice process, victims shall be entitled all of the following rights: which shall vest at the time of victimization and I think this part is important, be protected by law in a manner no less vigorous than protections afforded to the accused. And some of those subsections, then, some of those specific rights listed under the Constitution now say to be treated with dignity, respect, courtesy, sensitivity, and fairness, to proceedings free from unreasonable delay, to be able to confer with an attorney from the government, to be heard in a proceeding, to full restitution from any person who has been ordered to pay restitution to the victim and to be provided with the assistance collecting restitution. Section 6 of that constitutional amendment does also say this section is not intended and may not be intended to supersede a defendant's federal constitutional rights or to afford party status in a proceeding to any victim. So my question is, and I don't know the answer to this, how do we factor in victims' constitutional rights to this balancing test? Because while a victim has a right to a, it doesn't say speedy disposition under the Constitution, but it says timely disposition of the case from unreasonable delay, a victim also has a right to restitution, which you're only going to get if the case reaches resolution. And a victim has a right to be treated with dignity, respect, courtesy, sensitivity, and fairness. And I don't believe for a minute that dismissing a case affords a victim those rights. And so I don't know. And, of course, there aren't constitutional rights for victims under the federal Constitution. So I'm not sure what to do about all this, but it concerns me greatly. And I've thought a lot about it and haven't gotten anywhere, but except down this rabbit hole.
Well, Justice, that's why Barker called the remedy here unsatisfactorily severe. And, of course, the state takes victims' rights seriously. The state is often the one asserting a victim's right to a speedy disposition under Chapter 950. But, yes, there's a tension here between justice for victims and a defendant's constitutional speedy trial rights, but that's why we, as a country, have developed the Barker versus Wingo analysis and its progeny to go through and determine whether there has been a violation, not just looking at the.
But there's nothing in that protects victims. There's nothing in Barker or its progeny. Barker doesn't talk about victims and doesn't talk about victims' rights.
No, it doesn't. There, at the time, victims' rights probably weren't much more than law review articles.
At best, if you can find one from that time, I would give you an A plus. I don't think so. Not till after that. But you're asking us now to look at how we're analyzing cases where there is a speedy trial demand, and you're asking us to take sort of a wholesale look at the balancing test. And I'm not real satisfied with. Happy to do that, but what do we do with these people who are impacted by these cases? What are we supposed to do about victims and their rights if we're going to look at Barker for the first time in decades?
Well, you could consider whether the victim has asserted a speedy trial request. It's unusual.
Right. What would be the mechanism for doing that? They don't have the right to file motions.
The state has, in a number of cases I saw back when I was a prosecutor, pointed out to the court that the victim has a right to a speedy disposition and ask for a sooner court date.
Right, and if that court date doesn't happen, there's no enforcement mechanism on the court.
No. This is a tension in the law that you've identified, and I don't have any good answers to reconcile a victim's rights, which are important, with the defendant's rights, which are important. Turning to the third factor, whether Ramirez made a speedy trial demand and how to factor that in, I want to be clear that the state is not saying that his pro se demands deserve no weight. They did put the state on some notice that he wanted a trial and wanted a speedy trial, but it shouldn't necessarily get the same weight as a counseled request for a speedy trial.
Why not?
Because a counseled request would presumably have the benefit of advice from counsel. They could talk about the benefits, the pitfalls, what they might have to forego in order to have a speedy trial.
A defendant has a right to represent himself.
And in that, I hesitate to cut you off, but directly
you
to that point.
Please go ahead.
I would agree that a pro se defendant who makes a speedy trial demand would deserve the full weight because he is representing himself.
Here, but the defendant finally, after frustration, filed a pro se speedy trial demand. That leads me to the question of, to what extent does timing enter into this balancing test as a factor?
Well, the state in its brief pointed out a number of federal cases where a delay of even 6 months after the attachment of the right means that the speedy trial demand is given less weight when balancing these factors.
I don't know why it gets any weight. I mean, he's represented by an attorney. You can't have hybrid representation, an attorney representing himself. I understand he's frustrated. I understand it was a long period of time, but I quite frankly don't understand why it carries any weight.
A court could disregard pro se filing. That's been understood in Wisconsin law for decades. But when it comes, one of the state's biggest concerns in a case like this is, when was the state on notice that this was going to be a trial? When was the state on notice that the defendant wanted a speedy trial? So something that comes in 36 months, I think it was, 32, I think maybe the first one was, nearly 3 years into the case is when the first time someone said speedy trial. I'm not saying it gets no weight. I'm saying it should get minimal weight.
Counsel, is presumption of a violation enough here, or do you presumption of prejudice, I'm sorry, or do you need actual prejudice to trigger a violation?
We don't believe that the delays in this case rise to the level of presumptive prejudice. The state was willing to accept 334 days of delay, and when the speedy trial demand was made nearly 3 years in, I don't think you start weighing the delays after those quite as heavily. So, no, this is not a case like Doggett. This does not rise to that sort of level. In our brief, we cited a number of federal cases about presumptive prejudice, and while there's no bright line rules, one theme appears to be that presumptive prejudice isn't really a factor until you have 5 years of delay attributed to the state.
So my question of, is presumptive prejudice enough to trigger a speedy trial violation, or do you need actual prejudice?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court in Doggett said exactly that sometimes delays by themselves are prejudicial enough that you don't need a showing of actual prejudice, noting often the difficulty a defendant would have in proving actual prejudice.
Well, what actual prejudice did he have? He was in custody on other charges. He wasn't going anywhere. I would suspect even if he had his trial on this particular charge and was acquitted, the institution was still going to keep him in a more secure area because of the fact that the allegation is so serious. I don't know what prejudice he suffered.
The state's position is he suffered no actual prejudice. He couldn't make any showings, and as you noted, he was already in custody. He identified no witnesses, no forgetfulness. There is no actual prejudice here, which is why I'm talking so much about why presumptive prejudice shouldn't apply. As your honors are well aware, these cases are not amenable to bright line rules, and that's why there's multiple factors to go through. The job of the reviewing courts is to apportion the responsibility for the delays, assign them weight, look at whether there's been a speedy trial demand, and then determine whether there's any prejudice. If there's no further questions, I'll yield my time.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision and hold that Mr. Ramirez's speedy trial right was violated. The Court of Appeals correctly applied the Barker factors to the facts of this case, which involves a nearly four-year delay on straightforward charges of battery and disorderly conduct with no pretrial litigation. Yet the trial was reset numerous times, each time pushing the trial date back.
Well, a simple battery wouldn't put you in prison for 12 and a half years. So,
a battery by prisoner, but in terms of
I know what you mean.
The complexity of the charges.
Yeah,
correct.
And I agree. The complexity, and you could tell from my questions to Attorney Flynn, that is the adjournment that kind of got under my skin, that I didn't understand, quite frankly, why the state would have asked for that particular adjournment with what looks to me to be a relatively simple fact pattern.
Correct. And I just would note just as well that there were multiple times where that was the reason for delay. So not just once, but twice it was a retirement of a DA or other office turnover and switching of prosecutors. So Mr. Ramirez did twice assert his speedy trial rights on the record. And despite this, there were these delays.
He did that almost 3 years, though, after he was arraigned, I believe, or when the complaint was filed. I can't remember exactly. But he waited a really long time. So I don't think that weighs heavily in his favor, right?
He did wait a long time. But again, if you look at what's happening in the case, where we have these trial dates being scheduled, so he didn't assert his speedy trial right, say, for example, at the preliminary hearing or at the arraignment, because a trial date was scheduled out in the future. But then when we get to that trial date 5 or 6 months after the preliminary hearing, it gets rescheduled and pushed out again. And so he's waiting for these trial dates to happen, and they keep not happening and keep getting pushed back. And I think that's an important distinction between Mr. Ramirez's case and some of the other cases where courts do weigh that delay in assertion of the right less heavily.
But
for example,
some of the time, at least once, it happened because his attorney asked for a new date because he decided I'm not sure if he changed his plea to NGI or he was contemplating changing his plea. I mean, that's not competency. That is something that he chose to do as a matter of strategy. And to put that, to blame the state for that, or to say somehow the state or the court system did something to delay his trial when he either changed his plea or contemplated changing his plea for a strategic reason makes no sense to me.
I'll answer that question carefully. What the record shows is that trial counsel wrote to the court and asked for an adjournment so that trial counsel could investigate whether an NGI plea was appropriate. We don't have anything further on the record about that until then Mr. Ramirez himself files this pro se motion for asserting his speedy trial rights. There's more delay, and then when he files his motion to dismiss, and that's actually a hearing held on the record with Mr. Ramirez present, that's where Mr. Ramirez is disavowing that he had wanted that. So I think at the very least, the defense has never argued that all of that time in between defense counsel requesting a continuance to investigate and that speedy trial first pro se demand is made, that time period should be weighed against the state, that understandably that was a defense request for a continuance.
So that would be from March 6th of 2018
until
September 26th of 2018?
Correct.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. You're saying that period of time should not be counted against the state.
That the defense has not argued that would be weighed against the fact.
Okay, because the Court of Appeals, weighted that heavily against the state.
The Court of Appeals, and looking back, I don't believe they weighted that whole portion. There may be some where they weighed against the state for what the Court of Appeals was concerned about was there wasn't anything being put on the record for long periods of time. And so the defense attorney had requested a continuance of the trial date, and then there really seemed to have been no follow-up as to the progress of this investigation. You know, was there going to be a change in plea? What was happening with the case? That nothing is happening until Mr. Ramirez triggered some further action by filing that pro se letter.
And just to follow up on Justice Karofsky's questions to Attorney Flynn, how do the victims' rights play into all this?
Victims' rights play into this pretty heavily. And I do think that Barker, though not in depth, but did acknowledge that this is one of the rare constitutional rights that doesn't just protect a defendant, but it also protects victims and ensures the criminal justice system is working for society as a whole. That is, it is set up to ensure that the court system is going to keep moving so that the defendants can have their day in court, but also that the victims can have their day in
court. How do you count against the victim in this particular fact pattern, the situation where a DA asked for an adjournment or the courthouse was being remodeled and only one courtroom was available? That seems to me to be patently unfair to count those time frames against the state and the victim. And I know what the Court of Appeals said. They talk about it as basically government, in essence. But that just seems really unfair to me to count those periods of time against the state and the victim.
Well, it's being counted against the government as a whole, because that is who has the duty to bring a defendant to trial, both the prosecution and the judiciary. And situations like a retiring DA, that is an example that's really analogous to the Hadley case. In that case, it was an ill judge, and I believe a second retiring judge. And what the Hadley court said is that those delays aren't intrinsic to the case, because a new judge could come in and take over. And obviously, it does create some difficulty for a new judge or a new prosecutor to come in and familiarize themselves with the case. But that is the demands of the justice system, not just for a defendant, but also for a victim.
But what about the remodeling of the courthouse?
I think that's similar. The only difference is it's a physical location instead of the staff doing the work. And so if a county is remodeling and they are suddenly down to having one courthouse, perhaps they need to find alternative locations to have a trial. I mean, we saw a lot of that happening during the COVID pandemic, where in order to have enough space to have jury trials, different locations were used, and courts were able
to get
that done.
Well, some different locations, I'm going to push back on you, and Mr. Ramirez's case, I can assure you that wouldn't have happened. He would have had to have been held in a secure facility, a secure holding facility, in order to have his trial go forward. There would be very few alternate locations where he could have had a trial.
And again, that may be true, and it may be things that courts have to consider in planning out the scheduling, but the case law, both Barker and Hadley and Green, they do make clear that those systemic delays are weighed against the government, not heavily, but it is still the government's duty to keep the justice system moving. I think that something that's important to note about this case is it is an outlier in terms of what we see when we look at the case record and the record that was made in terms of what was happening. It's very common, and the state is arguing that this is some onerous or unreasonable burden, but it's actually quite common during status conferences to put on the record one or two sentences about where each party is in the case, how the discovery has been exchanged, how much they have.
I think that
depends
which county you're practicing in.
And it may.
Especially in, I mean, I'm not going to speak about Milwaukee County. There's enough Milwaukee County judges, former judges, now justices on this bench, who I think will tell you how crazy busy Milwaukee County is. I've only had the chance to observe it. But I'll tell you, in Dane County, which was pretty busy, I had 1,700 cases assigned to me every year as a criminal judge. That is not true. I did not have time to put that information on the record for a status conference.
But in Dane County, Your Honor, there are forms that the parties will go over together and sign, and those forms are entered into the record memorializing the status of the case. And so it need not even be an on-the-record hearing, but something to make a record.
You would be fine if they had just had more status conferences in this case. I find that hard to believe because it wouldn't have brought the – in fact, it may have drawn things out. The more court dates you have scheduled, the more you are going to push out the scheduling in general of a jury trial.
So, and just to clarify, what's lacking here is not, you know, additional status conferences, but what's lacking is a record made of what is happening in the case and why there are the delays, and when there are continuances granted, why they are being granted for the amount of time that they are being granted.
Okay, the last...
You and I are looking at this really, really differently. I mean, so your client is arraigned on October 26th of 2016. Okay? The trial date is... There's a witness unavailability problem, right? And so the first scheduled trial date is on April 3rd, which is only 6 months after the arraignment, which in my mind does not seem to be unreasonable in the least. Somewhere in there in March, about 6 weeks before the trial, the state realizes that this is going to be a three-day trial and not a one-day trial. What would you have the state do in that situation? If the trial commenced, there would have to be a mistrial. You'd have 1 day of trial. You'd get to the end. There wouldn't be enough time. What would you do? Bring the jurors back several months later? But just, it doesn't make any sense. Like, the state did exactly what the state should do, and they needed another date. So then the next date, it moved it from a trial date of April of 2017 to September. Again, that's only, it's 5 months. I mean, I'm not seeing, and then we talked about the NGI. That's why the second trial date got moved to a third trial date. And again, it went from September to April. That's 7 months. I mean, none of these are huge gaps in scheduling. And for every one of the continuances for a trial, there's a reason for it.
Well, again, not all of those reasons are intrinsic to the case. The first one with the
I know, but you're saying that they're not status conferences, so we don't know what happened. I know exactly what happened between each and every one of these.
But what the Court of Appeals found problematic was that there was a record as to why the trial date was taken off the calendar. And then the trial date was rescheduled, but there wasn't a record as to why it was rescheduled 5 to 8 months
And that
later.
Is where I have a problem. What do you expect a trial court to do? To say, okay, I've got a trial date here, and the trial date is on April 13, 2017. You need 3 days for trial. Now I am going to reschedule your trial for September 26th of 2017. And let me tell you why. Let me go through week by week of my calendar and tell you everything that I have to do. All of the pretrial conferences, all of the final conferences, all of the motion hearings, all of the other trials. And is that really what we want circuit courts to be doing? Because if we do that in every single case, it is going to be an enormous, enormous time suck for circuit court judges. That doesn't make any sense. There's nothing about when these are rescheduled, those time gaps, that cause me any concern whatsoever.
Well, what isn't clear, and what we're here today, the state is asking this court to assume that these time periods are reasonable, to assume that they are the first dates that the court's calendar had available or that the parties had available. But the record doesn't reflect that. And, of course, the judge need not go through every week of their calendar on the record, but a simple statement that the parties conferred and the first available date that all are available is X.
But that's what's done uniformly when courts, I mean, a number of us have served as trial court judges. You get the first date available. The judge or clerk starts throwing out dates, and the attorneys say, I can't do that, I can't do that. That is not put on the record. We have a shortage of court reporters. When I was there, children's court reporters had to go off to another court when we were doing things that didn't have to be put on the record.
And the defense is not asking for that extensive conversation to be placed on the record. But what isn't on the record here, what is missing here, is confirmation that that discussion occurred and that it was, in fact, the earliest date that was available.
Like magic when doesn't words. It occur, though? I mean, that it goes without saying. Listen, judges want to clear their calendars as much as the attorneys do, sometimes more. We don't want cases lingering forever, and every judge is very conscious of the rights, as you're hearing today, of not only the victims, but the defendants, too. They have a right to have their cases heard promptly as possible. This may be an outlier, but I want to ask you about what prejudice did your client suffer? He was going to be in prison for a very long time, so his liberty interest was not even implicated with this delay. Can you address that?
That's correct. It did not implicate his liberty interest. He was serving a prison sentence. He did offer testimony about the impacts of the pending charges on him that he believed prejudiced him. The trial court did not find that testimony particularly credible and didn't weigh that in his favor, and we're not asking the appellate courts to, you know, overturn or find those findings of fact wrong. But what did happen in this case was that the extensive amount of delay does reach the level of presuming prejudice for his case.
And that's another error I want to talk about that the Court of Appeals made at the outset. You said that the Court of Appeals applied Barker factors correctly. The Court of Appeals did not. And I want to see if you'll concede that at the outset with the threshold inquiry of whether the delay was presumptively prejudiced, the Court of Appeals started by weighing that heavily against the state. That was error. Do you concede that?
I don't concede that, Your Honor. I'm confused by the state's argument on that point because I think the case law is clear. Both Doggett and here in Wisconsin, the Erdahl case has also said this, that the first factor is it includes two inquiries. So the first is there a presumptive delay that triggers the remaining analysis? So typically we look at that as a 12-month delay. And so first it's, you know, if you don't meet that 12 months, then you don't need to apply the rest. But the second inquiry is if you do reach that 12-month, then you do look at how long is the total delay. And, you know, to how much does it extend past that presumptive minimum that you need to even do the analysis?
But that comes later in the analysis. It can't be weighed heavily against the state until you balance it against the other factors under the Barker test.
The way that Doggett applied it, Doggett looked at two things. It looked at the length of delay, and it specifically said it was a twofold inquiry and that you do look at how long it stretches. And that does then weigh, you know, it's a balancing factor like any other. So you can say this factor, in this case, of four times the presumptive minimum, that factor weighs against the state. Then also when you're looking at the fourth factor, the length of delay comes in to play as well to show that as, you know, even though there isn't a demonstration of actual prejudice in this case, as we assume that as time goes on and the more time that goes on, there are prejudices to a defendant's case. So it really plays on those two factors. I don't think that the Court of Appeals erred because of that language of it being a twofold inquiry on factor
but
one.
But what was the prejudice? There's no liberty interest at stake because he's going to be in prison for a long time. I didn't see any allegation or suggestion in your briefing that his case was actually prejudiced because of the passage of time, witness unavailability, nothing like that. So what is the specific prejudice to your client?
In Hadley, this court has said that most interests of a defendant are prejudiced as a matter of law the more time that goes by. And so if there is an excessive delay, that we assume that there was some prejudice. It's prejudice that can't always be quantified or demonstrated on the record.
Are we supposed to balance that, then? You're asking us to balance something that's like ether.
Well, in that, then, it does, in this case, it may be a factor that is less heavy, but it's still, the defense argues, weighs in his favor. But again, even if it didn't, if the other three factors weighed in...
No, I understand that, and I understand maybe why you want to pivot away from the prejudice, but I'm not seeing any prejudice here.
And again, both Barker, Hadley, the Supreme Court case of Moore versus Arizona have explicitly said that a defendant does not need to make an affirmative show of prejudice in order to suffer a speedy trial violation.
I want to go back to this idea of the explanation that the state's supposed to give, because obviously this case, whatever we say about it, is going to impact other cases and how people look at the speedy trial, the constitutional speedy trial violation. So I see the Court of Appeals in paragraph 48 and I think elsewhere focus on the fact that it's the state's responsibility to offer an explanation for the delay in the rescheduling of the trial. And that, to me, I wanted to know where, you know, they cite to Borghage, but those cases, and then Barker are talking about giving reasons for the delay. And I feel like those things have been merged together. And I hear you arguing that to us, too, that they not only have to give a reason for the delay, but they also have to give a reason why the trial wasn't scheduled earlier. Is that really what Barker and its progeny require from the state?
I think that those two things are being pulled apart into separate questions. I think the state phrased it in their briefing as the why and the why not sooner. But when you're applying, when you're doing this analysis and you're looking at the reasons for the delay, you can't explain a six-month period of delay between, for example, the original trial date and then the next scheduled trial date by saying, well, the trial was rescheduled because of an ill witness. Does that explain that 6 months? It explains why it was taken off the record, but that only explains the full delay if it explains why that time was necessary.
Okay. I don't know. So again, as Justice Grosky was saying, I don't think 6 months is all that long when you have a court that deals with thousands and thousands of cases. This was a general jurisdiction court. They're not divided even into criminals. They've got civil, they've got criminal, they've got family, juvenile, they've got everything, right? So I don't know. So you think that no matter what, part of what the state has to do is explain why it took so long to reschedule the trial and not just give a reason for the delay?
Particularly in a case like this where it's happening multiple times. And so there is a trial that's rescheduled for 6 months, and then again, as that 6 months is approaching the trial date, it's again taken off the calendar, and again, it's another 6 months, and then it happens yet again where it's the same thing, including the last one after that speedy trial demand was made. And so,
but can I just stop you because I'm looking at Borghage. Is that how we're pronouncing it?
That's how I did, but who knows?
Okay. I'm going to go with it. In at 513 in that opinion, part of what the court faults the state for doing there is not explaining why a trial date was adjourned. And for every adjournment in this case, the state has provided an explanation.
And that is one distinction. I believe there were two adjournments in the Borghage case. One was explained, one was not. And so that you're correct that is a distinction. What I do see as applicable from Borghage is that cavalier disregard. And I do want to address the state's comments regarding that. I disagree that the Court of Appeals is creating any new doctrine or factor with this language. I think it comes from this court, it comes from Green, as a description of circumstances that will weigh more heavily against the state. So we know that intentional obfuscation by the state, intentional delays to hurt a defendant's case are weighed heavily. And then we know that negligence on the part of the state, things having to do with congestion or, a failure to find a defendant will be weighed less heavily. This cavalier disregard is in the middle of those two and weighed more heavily for that reason. So it's not a new standard. It's a description of what the actions that are or are not being taken by the state. Again, I just want to come back to the state is asking this court to assume on a very bare record that there were reasons that should not be weighed against the state. The state is arguing that the retirement of a DA is a neutral reason that doesn't weigh at all, or I think later they clarified and said it should weigh lightly.
Counsel, I understand your record arguments. What I don't understand is this. Is it your position that an incarcerated person is equally entitled to a speedy trial right as a non-incarcerated person?
Exactly correct, Justice Bradley.
Is it your position that this court should dismiss the prejudicial nature of the delay because he was already in prison? It seems like some of the questioning that's going on is, hey, he's not prejudiced, he's already in prison. How does that factor into what we should do as a court here?
Well, the court should look to, obviously, the way that that other courts have handled this and looked at, for example, Doggett looks at the length of the delay. Hadley looked at the length of delay and how that could infer prejudice, even though it can't actually be detailed and quantified on the record. And other cases have shown that regardless of whether they are incarcerated on pretrial, whether they are released, whether they are serving a different sentence, each defendant does have the right to a speedy trial. And if we don't allow those who are serving other sentences to assert this right.
But I don't think anyone's doing that. I think we're trying to figure out what the prejudice is. So let me ask you, was there any prejudice to his defense? Were there witnesses that couldn't be found because of the delay?
There weren't witnesses that couldn't be found. But again, when you're talking about a four-year time period, we don't know how that impacted witness recollection, things like that. And so that's what Hadley was talking about when it was saying that where you have these excessive delays, the prejudice to a defendant's case isn't always quantifiable. Things are lost in time that aren't always easy to identify in an argument or through an evidentiary hearing.
But it does seem like that. If you look at Doggett, the debate is over the fact that you don't have proof of actual prejudice. What do you do? And I agree that court says, even if you don't have proof of that, that could be enough. But there it says, listen, if the government exercises reasonable diligence, of course he's going to lose if there's no prejudice. But maybe if it's really out there, and here 8.5 years, 6 years of it, but for the, egregious conduct of the government or inexcusable oversights, that maybe we're going to say is just kind of too much without any rebuttal. It just feels like that's a pretty extreme fact pattern that's difficult to match here, since you seem to be relying not on any actual prejudice, which is obviously incredibly relevant for the argument here, but just on this sort of Doggett-style presumption that this is way too long. Most of it's attributable to the government. The government is exercising extreme negligence here in a way that that he should go free. That's kind of really what you're resting on, I think, right?
It is, and I mean, I would note that the Doggett case, the facts are different in the sense that that individual was not serving another sentence. He was not incarcerated. He was walking free with no knowledge that he had these charges pending. So that prejudice to him wasn't there at all, and it was government negligence in that case, just failure to find him since he had gone abroad and failure
but,
to...
But you haven't identified any actual prejudice here either. I mean, I agree. Some of the cases talk about... We're going to presume it's going to be a little harder over the passage of time, but you know, there are cases where there's, you know, somebody is actually incarcerated, and that matters, and that matters significantly in the cases that being at the core of the Sixth Amendment, right?
That's true, and in those cases, that factor would probably weigh heavier than it does in this case. I think the important thing here is just that even if the only prejudice, and I see my time is up. Even if the only prejudice is this sort of, you know, presumption as a matter of law that the excessive delay caused some harm to the defendant's case, that is enough to satisfy just an evaluation of the case as a whole. We shouldn't just deny him because he has a weaker argument on that factor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Flynn.
I want to touch briefly on a suggestion that was made about the quality of the record, and I agree this is a sparse record. Ideally, there should be more, but the lack of a record here doesn't necessarily imply that no work was happening on the case. There could be cases where nothing will show up in CCAP, but the defense is investigating. There might be plea negotiations going on. The case can still be actively progressing, but without a record on CCAP.
So, I mean... It could be that a variety of reasons. I mean, aren't we tied to a record in our analysis rather than supposition?
Right, but one of the issues I have with the Court of Appeals decision is its reliance on hindsight bias to fault the state and then weigh period when the record could be better, but especially when the court went on to say that the state didn't provide a reason, the why not sooner reason, which is another issue the state has with this opinion. How much of a delay is too much? How much time does a valid reason get the state? That's massively unclear after the Court of Appeals decision. I want to touch on Hadley and Borjegi just briefly. Those cases are quite different. Hadley was an 18-month delay after the defendant filed his speedy trial demand within 1 month of being charged. And similarly in Borjegi, there was an unexplained delay after a prompt speedy trial demand. That goes to the importance of weighing all the factors, considering when the speedy trial demand was made. Justice Karofsky, I want to touch briefly on the victim's rights issue. My co-counsel reminded me that there is a mechanism for victims to petition, I think it's for mandamus, if their rights are being violated. I'm unaware of any cases where that's happened, but I believe there might be a mechanism there. Noting at the outset, the Court of Appeals looked at the overall length of the delay and said that weighed heavily. If the overall length has independent weight, then the remaining steps are superfluous. The state's view is that step one is a triggering mechanism. You then have to decide the reasons for the delay, apportion them weight, go through steps three and four. And I turn back to the sort of hypothetical I posed about a defendant could cause years and years of delay. Sometimes that's a valid tactic on their part. So then they would have an overall length of delay that might be quite large, but if they created all of it, then they're not going to be able to show a speedy trial violation.
Is your position different than you perceive that of the defendant, that the presumption of prejudice is a triggering event for
going forward with further analysis? Is that
that's
what
I
you
see
just
it.
Said? Is it your perception that that's the way the defendant sees it also?
No, I believe counsel made an argument that you do look at the overall length and it can have independent weight when assessing these four factors. So that is a point of disagreement between us. The state does also ask this court to presume that when the parties agree upon a next court date, that it is reasonable, that in the absence of an objection or something else in the record, what the parties agree to should be considered a reasonable amount of time for the case to come back in.
You want that part of our holding in this case?
I think this court should recognize that when parties agree to the next date to come back in, that their agreement and assent in that should matter in a speedy trial analysis.
How about something that was more like we focus on what the reasons for the delay are and we don't require, as no case has required, that someone give reasons for the length of time it took to reschedule the trial?
I'd be perfectly happy with that. Well, if there's no other questions, I'll yield the rest of my time.
Right. Thank you very much for interesting oral argument. Appreciate you being here today. The court will adjourn on this first case and reconvene when the courtroom is ready for the second case. Thank you.